Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatec.
No, you're working at Inatec because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world, and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Holland, Andrew on the board. Andrew has had a harried morning. It's called a car phone and cab morning, but we think we have it straightened out, and he'll be back together because one is, you're not complete without your phone anymore, are you, Andrew?
No, I am half gone.
Half gone? There you go. We have Professor Kevin.
You do. Hey, how far away from home would you get before you went back to get your phone?
Well, right now, are you saying like hypothetically, like if I left home?
Yeah, and hypothetically, I'm like if I were to get in the car and go to work today,
I see.
I would have to wonder myself about how far would I get? Would I get all the way to the office and say no? I got to turn around and go back. Would I get halfway? I'm not sure. But how far would you get?
I think if I left it at home, I could almost leave it there. But leaving it in a cab, you know, that's like immediate.
That's a different problem.
Yeah. Yeah, if I left it at home, I'm like, eh, whatever.
See, now I get no end of abuse for this from my peers or the creatures around me. But I actually went out and I, you know, bring a bag every day trying to work out and so forth. In my bag, I bought like the world's cheapest flip phone. And it only costs $6 more a month to
have it on your plan.
Have it on your plan. And I just have that in the bag. And if ever I forget mine, I can just call a few people and say, by the way, this is the number today if you really need me.
Yeah, I use the alternate number, yeah.
And but, you know, plus, if ever you were actually, you know, if you went on a walk or something, it's way better. It weighs nothing. It goes right in your shirt pocket. And if you ever have to actually talk on the phone, the thing charge it up and it lasts like 2 weeks or something. I'm not saying everybody should go back and use that as your regular phone, but for 6 months a month, it's kind of a... Because nobody remembers anybody's numbers. I don't.
Well, using it as your regular phone ain't the worst idea either.
No. I mean, I almost figured that, you know, if I had to do it all over again, I'd probably get a nice tablet and maybe one of those. But you need some sort of internet on there, and this one doesn't have that. Because if you're gonna park, you got to use the parking app in the city or something. I mean, I have a couple apps you have to use, and you really, it's gotten so you almost can't go somewhere without a couple of them. I mean, I have like two apps on my phone, but I'm not gonna. Maddie Weber told me never put your credit card in one of the parking meter things. So he says that app is way safer. So a couple things, you know, you definitely want. If I were to actually get a smaller phone to use as my regular one, there's some out there that'll do some internet stuff. They're more expensive, of course, and of course they're a little heavier. But I mean, having a backup phone is almost easier than having a backup phone directory in your bag. Same thing. Anyway,
that was going to be my next question: is how many phone numbers do you have memorized now, Tom?
I have memorized the phone numbers where people used to live before they have phones.
Andrew, how many phone numbers do you know off the top of your head?
He's off to the good coffee.
Okay.
I would. In other words, I know.
I know mine.
I know mine.
this was going to be for Andrew's benefit. Is, you know, we used to know everybody's phone number.
Yeah.
We just memorized them.
Well, that's right. And I still like know Dan's phone number from where he was in Beverly, where we used to live. Those kinds of things. But I mean, anybody knew. But, you know, you don't have to, so you don't do it. You know, it's like even some of the facts you would normally you know, can put the memory, just kick them right up on the computer again. And it's a really, it's an advantage in a lot of ways, but it's sort of not either. You know, in a way, I was thinking of the craziest thing. We were talking a little bit about yesterday on the show, we're kind of combining some of the junior college and high schools in some areas. And we did that a little bit, Kevin. I had two classes from Thorn Ridge when I was a senior at Marist. One was a history and one was something else. It wasn't any of the core courses. They weren't into that yet. But I got to Notre Dame. The guy goes, "I'll give you credit. Good job." That was the credit. That was the credit I got. But you know, there was a kind of a weird little story nobody cares about, but I'll tell it anyway. When I was at the University of Chicago, one thing Notre Dame did, I'll say, I don't know how many schools do it or don't do it, but your finals week, they spread the finals out over like the whole week. So if you had an 8 o'clock, a 9 o'clock, and a 10 o'clock class, you'd have three finals right in a row. The 9 o'clock might be at 9 o'clock.
On different days, yep.
Yeah, the 10 o'clock might be 7 o'clock the next night or something. It was literally a finals week. But the University of Chicago didn't do anything like that. So for me, I was always scrunching classes together because I was driving over there. Well, that's a problem because I took four courses. You're supposed to take three. Well, you're supposed to take four twice and three four times. But I took four more so I could get out earlier. But I had three right in a row. And the one in the middle was marketing. And the one on each side were, like, really tough. So I'm sitting there going, "I there's one of these I can't study for. I'm just going to let the marketing one go." Sure enough, I go in there, and there's a thing in there and said, "Explain totally the wheel of retailing." I don't know if you ever heard what that is. I'm sitting there going, "Boy, I know I heard about this one in class, but I have no idea what this is." So I took a guess. One of my guesses in life was spot on. The wheel of retailing it refers to if somebody says, "Okay, we're just going to be cheap prices. We're going to give people just the value. We're not going to buy any shelves. We're just going to put, you know, the wine cases out there, and people can pull them right out of the case, and we'll put a little sign on the price, and we have the absolute minimum stuff because we can sell stuff cheaper than anybody else." So all of a sudden, after a while, so you know, you get enough. Your business is good, and the clients come in and get, "Boy, you know, if I could see the stuff on the shelves, I'd probably buy more," or some story. And then maybe you do that, or maybe if somebody doesn't like it, you let them bring it back, or like a regular like Marshall Fields, you can always take stuff back. Or maybe now we give everybody fancy little, if you buy four bottles, we give you a fancy little wine carrier or something. So all of a sudden your costs creep, until one day somebody says, "Wow, that guy's selling that wine for $20. If I just put the case out on a concrete ground, I could sell it for 18 or 17, and it starts all over again. And it's called, you know, and it's referred to as the wheel of retailing. I'm saying, well, that guy, if he was still alive, he would apply that right now to what's going on in education, I think. I was just thinking, I was waiting for Andrew to call this guy. When you look at a Notre Dame education, or Northwestern's even worse, and we paid, you know, $1,000 for room and board, roughly. Was it $1,025 or something? And it wasn't bad. I mean, you had a dorm room that now would be appalling. But, and we had, you know, chicken and mystery meat every night, and, you know, burgers for lunch, and, you know, it wasn't the best cuisine, but it was okay. And so all of a sudden you start charging $2,000, $3,000, $5,000. I think Northwestern charges, last time I looked, Kevin, was $17,000 for room and board. Well, now your mom walks in and says, "Wait a minute, I'm not paying $17,000 for an army cot, one small pillow, and chicken every night." So all of a sudden, if you go into the Notre Dame cafeteria now, I did last reunion, Kevin, it's like a four-star restaurant. If you want salads, they got salads. If you want Mexican food, they got that. If you got this, if you want ice cream, you got sundaes. I mean, literally, you know, a month in there must cost them $1,000 a person. So what you're seeing, and what, I don't even know you're doing it, is in your place, what you're saying is, let's strip all that crap away. That's not education. I don't know what it is exactly. We're going to go back to educating people for a price that regular people can afford. And it's exactly the same principles. And all that's happening in some of the universities. It's not happening at the universities because they're so far gone, the horse will never get back in the barn. But it's happening at every other level, isn't it?
Well, I think so. You know, this is interesting times in Indiana. You know, as you know, for decades, Indiana's had the Indiana's budget has been in great shape. Not true the last couple of years. They've run a substantial deficit the last couple of years.
I heard that, Kevin. What's causing it? Is it just education, or what are you about to tell them?
No. I don't think it's just education. I think it's I think we just had a really crappy governor. Spent a lot of money. Some of the examples are in the COVID dollars. Where, you know, we weren't spending it on anything COVID related, so we were doing all kinds of other crap with it that created financial commitments going forward that were not part of, you know, the COVID dollars were a one time event, and this was big, you know, this was a revenue stream. That was part of it. Just a lot of frivolous spending in general, and so now we elect a new government. Our new governor, who had been a senator, and he's coming in saying, "Hey, we got to get this back on track." Well, that's reached into education, so you know we've lost like 10% of our funding from the state, and had to let go a lot, like a couple hundred people across the state, now we're scrambling to figure out how we're going to make the fall term work. But the Commission on Higher Education said part of this deal is you ain't raising tuition. That was off the table. And the logic there was, and I'll circle back on this a minute because this has been a longstanding complaint of mine. If you raise tuition, you lose some students, so you lose some, the question is what's the price elasticity on it and how does it work? But they made the decision, said we're not going to do that. We're still going to educate our students and try and provide value. So that's, I think that's a good attitude. It is a challenge. And, part of our problem, and I'm pretty sure this is true of every educational institution on Earth, is we think in terms of expense and we do not think in terms of revenue impact. So, if we do scale some things, I'll give you an example. After post COVID lockdowns, we have never gotten our Elkhart location back up to the same level of activity, on campus classes and so on. We've just not, our enrollment's been good, but we haven't brought it to the campus in Elkhart as much. As a result, we've been planning a marketing blitz this summer, and I added some extra courses in my areas on the fall. We decided which areas we're going to use for focus and so on. And now I'm sitting here saying, okay, well, we don't have our marketing director anymore. And I have an open full-time position that's going to be put on hold. So are we still going to do this marketing blitz? And if so, what are we going to do if we succeed? So we don't think in terms of revenue. Now, I have some really good revenue ideas. I think we'll probably do some non-academic stuff that can create revenue. But I don't think a lot of people are focusing on that. So that's when you're looking at state budgets and state funding and how all that works, you have a real challenge to try and say, because anything you do on the revenue side takes a little bit longer to ramp up, assuming you're successful, and at the same time, the expense, anything you do on the expense side that you cut now. And that's a challenge. Russell's got the same challenge. So, when he comes on later, we should probably talk about that, because all of the state schools, not just an Ivy Tech thing, this is, all the state schools took a haircut on this.
I think that we have here's a shot at all politicians. I'm going to say that even though I haven't done it in 35 years, Kevin, this is probably way too broad, but there probably isn't one person there that has half of the cost accounting knowledge that I have, and I've forgotten most of it. I mean, where do you start from? Just what you just said, we're not raising tuition, is send a shiver up my back. I'm sitting there going, okay, what expenses do you have? Are you over? Do you have too many people today? I mean, it's almost like zero based budgeting. although that was a total fiasco because nobody could ever do it. It's we have, let's say, for instance, you and I get a hair up our behind about having education downward, if ever the new thing going in at the U.S. Steel plant is going in. We're gonna rent half a CVS high school because it's half of it's empty. Place is huge. We're gonna put a university there. We're gonna be, you know, university of something something, whatever the hell it is, East Side.
Fox and Jocks University.
Yeah, you know we're gonna go get 25 of the professors. Some of them can do it at night, maybe if they actually have a regular job. Some can do it on Saturday. We're gonna get bare bones of this, and we're gonna pay people whatever we need to pay them, $10,000 a class. All right. I don't know what professors make, but say it's $10,000 a class, and we're going to make sure that there's 25 to 30 people in the class, not five. And we're going to divide one into the other. So if it's $10,000, what does that come down to? What's 10,000 divided by 30 is what? $500, something like that, $600. So we're going to get down to what does it cost us to run this school? We have to have some kind of an admissions department. We have to have something. And what's the overhead on the professor? Do we need to charge 1.5 times his salary, 2 times, 1.75, 2.5? It shouldn't be 3 or 4 or 10 like it is at University of California. So they're like 10. So it's at some point we're going to sit there and go, okay, we can do this for, if the professor's 10 and the overhead's going to be 1.5, that's 25 for this class. We got 25 guys. That's $1,000 a class, which is probably high, probably real high. But anything over that, so what you just said, we're going to hold tuition down. Well, the last two administrations have jammed inflation right up everybody's behind. I don't see how somebody can tell you guys not to raise tuition. I will bet you that your cost of hospitalization for your employees has gone up 15% in the last year. So what do you do with that? Do you have extra people or don't you? If you do, because you hired everybody during COVID because the money was flying in, well, okay, that's an easy solution, I guess, except for the people you're firing. But if you don't, how do you fire the one admissions person you have? Who the hell's going to let people in? How do you fire the guy who opens up the door in the morning? There's some level at which you can't go below. And people that make these kind of, you know, broad brush decisions have no idea what they're talking about in the sense of how efficient are you in the first place. If you got the biggest bloated place in the world and you say get rid of 10% of the people, hell, maybe you're doing them a favor. But what if you're not? What if you're already I have a feeling you guys are pretty efficient, that there's not that many extra people hanging around.
Well, yeah, I don't know that it would be, if I were organizing it, you know, if I were hired as the consultant to say how do we go about properly organizing it, there are places where I would deploy more and places where I deploy less. But I think we're, you know, as a school, we're pretty conscious of, you know, this is taxpayer money and we should be careful with it. So, you know, I mean, that's one of the good things about it. But nevertheless, there's always a tendency, and this is every single business I've ever seen, that when the times are really good, there's a, you know, you get a little bit loose.
Trudeau.
You get a little bit loose on the hiring. And then all of a sudden, things take a turn for whatever reason, and now, you know, you're into these cuts. And, you know, it's not the way I ever ran my departments. And I made damn sure I told everybody that I'm running my department pretty lean, so that when those times rolled around, I wasn't going to get nailed with it. But you know, once you've been through a couple of times when you're letting a lot of people go just because, just because things aren't going well, I don't like sitting down and having those conversations, and I just don't want to live through that if I can help it. So I'm a big fan, you know, I'm a cheap SOB when it comes to spending money, yeah, as a management person. And that's because, you know, I just don't want to set people up for that kind of a
fall. But somebody might have at some point decided, okay, we're only going to have 20 people in a class, and that's all well and good. But if you get squeezed a little bit, maybe there's one class in, whatever it is, it could be remedial algebra or some crap where, you know what, it wouldn't hurt us to have 50 people in this class, or 25 or 22 or something.
25 or whatever, yeah.
I mean, there's all kinds of little variables here that you can maybe squeeze, but if it's a class that has an awful lot of interaction, I don't know, maybe 20 is too many. You know what I mean? What I'm saying, as you go down the whole chain here, it always bothers me when people make broad brush, pontifications where, I'm thinking of you now, if you actually do run an efficient department, say you're the accounting department, and some pompous ass comes in and says, we're all cutting 10% across the board. Okay, some guy who, somebody who might have been somebody's brother-in-law and has a department with 15 extra people in a 25-person department, he can cut four people and he doesn't even care. But now you, all it does is penalize the good managers, right? Assuming you have some in the place. So I mean, you need to know your place better before you make these kinds of decisions. And when the worst people to do it are politicians, what do they know? We're not raising tuition for the next 10 years. Okay, fine. Well, are we going to lose five of our best professors, 10, 15, 20? What are we paying now? Are we at the low end or the high end? Well, if you're on the high end, maybe you can stay there for 5 years. But on the low end, I'm not so sure you can. Or you're going to lose everybody. I mean, there's a million variables to this. Whenever anybody makes it simple, I think they make themselves a simpleton or something. It's just me.
Yeah, and I don't have a sense that we're making it simple. I think it's a challenge because this all kind of came down as let's get to work. Well, at my level, I haven't had to be too involved in that, so I don't know what all the conversations were like. But this, this is just the, it's the normal thing. Actually, I do know what the conversations were like because I've been through it before, so it's... I probably could tell you exactly what all the conversations were like, but that would be based on experience, not having been there.
What do you make of it?
It's a challenging situation, What do I always tell people? Two things. One, because we have some other dynamics in our own college. In fact, let me say this out loud. If anybody wants to be the chair of the business accounting and entrepreneurship department, reach out to me. It's because we have an opening there. Our my counterpart, the chair who did that, took a job about 6 weeks ago as the as a vice chancellor of our CareerLink group, and she's fantastic.
Is she the one I met?
Pardon?
She the one I met?
You probably did meet her, yeah.
The African-American lady?
No, Amber was with us, and...
She was a chair of something, but she was leaving, wasn't she?
Yeah, Karen was leaving. I know who you're talking about. She works for South Bend Schools now.
Okay.
But my point of this is that that's an opening, and it kind of hurts, especially when and we are going to get to go ahead and fill that job because it's so critical. It's just one of those situations where this is a tough time to be down in a key spot like that. I also think long term it's probably. I'm going to get a lot of benefit about Amber being in this other job. So it was a good move for her. I'm glad she got the job. I'm sad she got the job.
Really? Yeah, well,
been a lot easier going forward for a while.
Can you make heads or tails on this U.S. Steel situation? I find the inconsistencies here. Plus, I need to talk to a couple of my steel mavens to find out. What exactly is going on with these guys? Are we just trying to preserve the name? What are we trying to do with this? I mean,
I'm not sure. Is this an investment that's supposed to be arm's length, or is this actually an acquisition dressed up as something else?
Oh, they're not going to put that kind of money in without control. Nobody would.
I agree.
But I noticed from a little bit, one of the guys I play softball with, he's in. He actually has a patent, and I think he's starting to get some good business. And he does steel coatings. So if you're gonna if you're going to put a beam in your building, you probably want to coat it. So after 100 years, it doesn't rust. Of course, we're not going to be here in 100 years, but still, somebody is. You see the ones that are all over the expressways now? They're not like the orange like they used to be. They're all gray. That's a new coating. It's supposed to be terrific. Anyway, and my scrap dealer buddy and my architect friend, together, they say when you come out of with steel scrap, he says you can actually make girders and stuff out of those things now, and you know, beams for expressways and so forth. I mean, that the recycling is like that good. I said, how is that better than starting with iron ore? He goes, you know how dirty iron ore is? This is a hell of a lot easier to start working with than it is fresh iron ore.
Recycling steel is a big time business. It's a cost saver for some of the people who buy it, and of course it's an environmentally sound practice.
Well, and then, you know, the other thing they recycle is concrete. I mean, you bust up the old concrete and you make new concrete with it, and actually it's good aggregate. But you know, these are kind of developments that, you know, we don't even realize in the last few years. But I know. When we were in college and high school, people talked about there's an open hearth method and there's another method of making steel. The open hearth one is you see the big huge fires and you see all the guys there, they're all hot as hell, and that's
yes.
And that was the U.S. because that was the only way, the original way to make steel. And then after the war, there was a new process, and a lot of the places in Europe were rebuilt with the new process. And I think the new process can take and redo the recycled steel, and the only problem with an open hearth furnace is it never wears out, so you hang with it as long as you possibly can, right? So I'm not an expert on this, but U.S. Steel has always been allegedly a little behind the times on this, and now they've got, obviously Southworks is closed, Gary's still open, I don't think it's anywhere near as big as it used to be. And there's a couple other people, as Arcola Mittal. Now, is that Japanese too? Owned, or somebody's owned. That used to be, was that Inland or was that Bethlehem? Somebody. And, you know, we're out getting a whole view of the U.S. steel industry. I mean, I understand the president saying we want some made here, for God's sake. I mean, we have to do that. But now, what exactly, if it was a going business, when I say going business, if people sit there and said, man, this U.S. steel place can make some dough, we have an operation in this country called stock market, called bond market, called IPOs. If people, we have banks, we have people with money, we have ways to get capital. Now, but if these people all say, I'm not interested, okay, so maybe a Nippon comes in and says, we'll buy all the property, we'll buy everything for X cents on the dollar. Because if we had to put all the, you know, the plant equipment and everything back together, and the rail access and all the stuff you guys have, you know, we'll essentially start over. We'll put the money in, and I'm thinking, if there's an investment there to be made, why do we need them exactly, Kevin? Or why are people here saying, go ahead, let those guys do it? And then, you know, we're going to protect the new company with a 50% tariff. Somehow or another, there's an inconsistency here that I can't get my arms around, because they're not telling me. I don't know what, but somehow or another, this is not the same program as we're going to put tariffs on everybody. And by the way, that means you're going to give everybody here a breather to where they can go out and borrow money and build a factory and get efficient, and all of a sudden we're not going to maybe need these tariffs, although I think Trump likes tariffs no matter what. But what are we really trying to accomplish? And I'm finding it very inconsistent. Is it just me? Or I'm not trying to be an ass to these guys. I'm saying it just seems inconsistent to me.
Yeah, well, or at least if there's a grand plan, it sure hasn't been shared with us, is it?
Yeah. I mean, I think the idea...
And I don't know what the answer is on that, Tom, as far as where the investment money should come from, because there is value to experience, which is what Nippon would bring if they were going to do modernization, they have experience in newer approaches and newer technologies. So there's some value to that that you don't get from outsiders coming in. Although you can get outside investors coming in who have experience and are willing to do it. I'm not sure what the right answer is. I think the whole what I'm sensing from what we're doing right now is doing everything we can to keep operations in the United States, not so much ownership.
Well, this all has to, the markets, I mean, maybe after a while, you know, one thing I kind of, well, I don't know if I learned or something, in grad school, Kevin, when you get to your end of your second year, I hope it's like the Belushi seeing the light over at the Penguins, right? You sort of see the light, you see everything is the same subject. Can't do marketing without finance, can't do finance without anything to sell. I mean, it all comes down to the same deal. And when you're talking about, you know, blustering about businesses leaving here, there are issues at why they left. I mean, and China is, I think, the big bug in the soup. They've got under the General Agreement of Tariff on Trade and the World Trade Organization, and they never really played by the rules. But they were so cheap, and people didn't care. Okay, so that's a problem, all right? But the other part of it is you can't say we're bringing stuff back to America and then show up with Saudi investors. I don't want... The idea is for people here, and people here have... The access to capital, to me, is way worse than it was 20 years ago. You couldn't get you and me with $500,000 buying 5 or 6 houses and remodeling them and maybe renting them out or doing something, whether it's a poor neighborhood or whatever neighborhood it is, and then going in and saying, okay, I've got 5 houses. I want a loan for the next 2 because this is what I have in my balance sheet. Oh, no, we want, like, personal guarantees. We want all this crap. The access to capital has totally dried up. Not totally, but it's seriously dried up for the people that every politician, and I'll put Biden and Trump on the same page, keeps claiming they're trying to help. They're not helping them at all. I mean, I'm not, they personally are not doing that, but the system, they obviously don't understand the system has turned from people like that. It's not that easy to get capital. If you want to go out and get money from one of these Shark Tank people, you know, those kinds of people, well, you got to give me 51% of your place, and oh, by the way, still pay 15%. Well, hell, I don't want that. If I succeed, I give it to you then. I mean, there's no thought process of how this all works its way down. I mean, Citigroup does not have any interest whatsoever in lending you and my money for our next house. I know some guys in the trading floor. When the trading floor closed, they put their own money together, bought houses at like $70,000, put $30,000 into them, and now they were renting them for, you know, whatever, $1,500 a month or something, making dough. They went to the bank for the 5th house. The guy goes, we're not giving you any money. That's your balance sheet. You need to put up cash, and neither one of them's wife wanted them to sign their house over. The access to capital was non-existent. And yet, why not? I mean, why are their balance sheet not good enough? I mean, if you're this, everything that every politician for the last 5 presidents has said, every word out of their mouth is for the middle class, and yet, taken in total, they have done nothing but screw the middle class. I mean, it's not Republican, Democrat, who's ever behind the curtain. They don't give a rat's ass about any of these people. Us, and it's pretty scary to me. I don't know how far we go.
Isn't that what Dodd Frank was supposed to do? It was supposed to protect the little guy.
It made it work.
Really, really hard for the little guy to get any funding for anything.
It's to the point where some of the little rules are, and the regulations they put on people. I mean, I'm a little jaundiced about this because we're undergoing our 3-year FINRA audit, and they've got 4 or 5 people that are younger, and they dream up stuff. It used to be, Kevin, that they at least would come into your office and have to sit here, you know, 4 days in a row doing God knows what, doing what they have to do, but now they don't even do that. They just sit somewhere and every hour or so just lob something at you. You got to give us this. You got to give us this. So it's totally painless. every day Dan gets a list of crap. Like, what do they need this for? What are they doing? I mean, it's especially since we just had our regular audit and a futures audit. It's the 3rd one, and it's June, for God's sake. We've not had a not audit going since the first of the year. I mean, what is all that for? There hasn't been any complaints. we don't do any crazy stuff. We don't have anybody with, you know, where their account is, is open to losing enough money where they lose their money or anything like that. We have nothing like that. I mean, and then the bigger people, they don't spend any more time on it. I'll bet they spend almost as much time here as they do at like Robinhood or something.
Well, even if you spend the same amount of time as the bigger people, what's that mean? Well, it means that as a percentage of the time available, they're spending less. I mean, the big guy can afford compliance a lot easier than the smaller guys can.
Well, the latest is Dan had to send him 10 of our shows. Do you really think that we want to pay some guy to sit there and listen to 20 hours of Stocks and Jacks hoping I screwed up?
Which ones did you send him?
I don't know. Andrew just picked 10 or Ricky. Maybe you send them all the ones that you're on them. I don't know.
Yeah, I was going to say, send them all the rabble-rouser ones.
Yeah, send them all the ones who are bitching about somebody. What did you make of, you don't have that much time, what did you make about the conversation we were having yesterday with Carl and Hal together about this? You know, if you were really a conspiracy nut, which maybe we're getting to be, you look at what's going on with this money flows overseas and you see the big Powell versus Trump. I mean, do you think these guys might just be being controlled by somebody and they're both too dumb to realize it or something? Something's going on here. Because I've actually heard a rumor from one of my wacky friends. Might have been a wacky listener. We might have a couple wacky ones. That they've heard.
We have wacky listeners?
That some really big money people now are setting up huge places to live in, like New Zealand or something. It almost makes you wonder if this isn't some huge pump and dump. We're gonna pump more money into the system. We're going to drive this market up. And every day, this NVIDIA goes up $25, $50, $100 billion in market cap. I mean, there has to be some. Every day. I mean, it's up $1.20 this morning so far. You got 25 billion shares outstanding. I mean, that thing goes up 4 or 5 hours. It's $100 billion. I'm thinking, Kevin, if we went back to 2000, did we even have any companies that were worth over... I don't think we had anywhere over a trillion. I mean, I'm saying maybe not even a couple. This thing has gone up a couple days where they went up $200 billion in value. I'm thinking 2000, we might have had three or four companies that were worth $200 billion. This is absolutely funny money on one level. And the next level, you look at people every single day, stuff's going up around them, whether it's insurance, whether it's cars, whether it's car repair, God help you. I mean, and there's no raises anywhere. I mean, I've never seen anything like this. I mean, you and I can argue about whether the politics is causing it. I'm saying whoever's ever been, I actually went back 32 years. We've had exactly 16 years of Republicans, 16 years of Democrats. I don't see any change whatsoever to where the cash has gone in the last 32 years. Have you?
Not much.
I mean, it's almost like whoever manages to get their guy in there, it doesn't even make any difference. I mean, right now we've seen, a huge shift towards taking this perceived money that people don't deserve and giving it back to people that, quote, do deserve. All right, well, that was different than Biden's, we're going to throw money at other people, that whether they work or don't work. I mean, either one of these plans seems to be very ridiculously thought out. And yet, and then you got Elon Musk fighting with the guy, which is even more bizarre.
Why is that bizarre? I think Musk represents a line of thought as it relates to this bill that is pretty prevalent. I told you a long time ago there might be some things in the bill that I like, but unless they start showing some real cuts, if I were to say something like take a trillion out of the annual. You know, knowing the accounting gimmicks and everything else that's going to be part of that, it has to be way bigger than that to have any impact. But unless we start scaling back what we spend, I don't think we could grow our way out of this. I don't care how successful we are re-engineering the economy. We got too much debt to grow out of.
And I also, the insulting part of this, I mean, this is, well, let's put it this way. The administration style is not my style. Everybody knows that. But somebody asked yesterday, who's the new mouthpiece, the lady gives you
hotel. I love it. Yeah.
She, I think, but Kevin, you probably know the numbers better than me. That the administration's estimate of this new bill is that it's going to somehow save a trillion something going forward, and you know, because this is going to happen, more investment, blah blah blah. I think the governmental budget office is what's their number? $7 trillion the other way. I mean, it's the most massive gap.
Yeah, and CBO didn't give them as much credit for growth as they think they should have. Okay, fine, but even so, we still got a spending problem.
So somebody asked her that question, and she goes, "Well, everybody knows the congressional budget office is wrong." Okay, now I'm not as good on you know, parsing words as Mr. Flanagan is, but I know one thing. If I say it's going to cost $100 to cut the lawn, and you say it's going to cost $105, I guess I can say I think Kevin's wrong, okay, and in one statement, and maybe, you know, keep my sanity. But if Kevin's estimate is like $5,000, and mine's $100, it's not the same to say, well, Kevin's usually wrong. Okay, if he comes in at $4,900, he's pretty close to being right. We have a huge spread problem here. It can't be glossed away. We're talking about almost $9 trillion. Oh yeah, those guys are wrong all the time. But how does that even begin to address the severity of the split? Right? I mean, just in terms of language and how, and the people you're talking to, how dumb do you think they are? Maybe I think they think we're real dumb. At every level of politician, somehow or another, whenever they get elected, they seem to think they get a lot smarter than we are. But what I'm saying, if you and I were like 2% apart, and I say, yeah, that Kevin guy's always wrong, well, that's one thing. If we're apart by like from here to Pluto, then so what? Kevin could be wrong by $100, and it's still more than my estimate, right?
Yeah, so I'm paying less attention to that. Like I said, my what I want to see out of all of this is I want to see spending cut in some meaningful way, in some way that's significant enough, specify the bill, so that even if they only deliver on half of it, it's still significant.
See, I don't know, Kevin. Maybe the areas that I wander around in are different. Again, I see this problem as being so entwined in everything here. When we talk about medical care, we talk about everything. It really comes down to, and we'll go through this on Friday, with the labor numbers. It really comes down to how many people are supporting themselves and, by definition, let's say, a tenth of another person through taxation and through whatever, through charities and whatever it is. And as soon as you see that participation number dropping, and I, well, I mean, Audrey stopped where she was doing a lot. Well, she's been working real hard, so on weekends I'm driving around. Of course, she's starving, so we stopped for a hot dog. And I just got to wait a little bit for a hot dog, and I'm watching everybody that walks in, Kevin. And I'm going to say out of 20 people, I'm going to say 15 of them look to me like they don't look healthy. I don't see any way on earth that they have a real job, and were maybe they're retired, or maybe they're retired early, maybe they have a disability or something. Somehow or another, we've got to get an awful lot more people doing something worthwhile, both for their own sanity, but for everybody, for the good of everybody. Unless we get, this is not a question of we can cut down enough money out of the thing for. You know, yes, should we get rid of waste? I got a couple of tax ideas that I think make absolute sense that'll never happen. You know, some perks that the rich get that they shouldn't get. But it's still not the number you're talking about. It's just an aggravation on my part. I mean, should we do something with long-term capital gains? Should we index them? Yeah. Should we get rid of the piggy move up? If your dad croaks, all of a sudden you get your IBM stock in a... Where's IBM? You get a stock at 263, even though he paid 50 cents for it. That's not right. I mean, but, you know, should he pay a full capital gains on it? Probably not. There should be some sort of an index. I'm saying some of these little quirks that are not going to balance the budget, like you're talking about. But we also have to find a way where an awful lot more people are actually going to work and doing something, all right, so maybe from home, and actually participate that we're not caring for them. Or the medical part where they're... I mean, how much did this COVID really damage people? I mean, if Carl's half-assed right, what's that going to cost us? I mean, nobody's addressing any of this stuff that we talk about on the show, Kevin. And that's really the scary part to me. Whatever side of the aisle you're on, it doesn't seem to matter. I mean, I can't stand Trump. Yet I'm also under no illusions that if a Democrat gets in there 3 years from now, everything I want to see happen is going to happen. It's not. I mean, that's my problem. I don't see any real change, do you? I mean, there might be some in the rhetoric or something, but in terms of who's getting helped and who's not, I don't see any change, do you?
I don't. I have some wait and see on all of this because I haven't seen an emphasis on trying to bring more jobs back onto the shores of the United States. I don't know if it's going to be successful or not. I don't know to what degree it can be successful. But we have to start getting those people on the couch that we talk about every jobs report. We've got to start getting more of those people back in the labor force. And, I think some of that is, especially in the construction industry, is very much tied to our willingness to pay substandard wages. It's the same it's the same problem we always have why we offshore things. We send it away for cheap labor, regardless of how it became cheap labor, regardless of what the cause and effect is behind there. And that does require a certain amount of ethics. We talked about this on Friday, and we'll see if any of that turns out. But even a dent in that would start us down a good path, and I don't know if we're going to get there or not.
I think there's a, and we'll talk about that a little bit on Friday. I think because we had a long conversation, or if you listened in when Bill Moriarty was on last week, he said the people that are willing to do these jobs all of a sudden we don't want here, and he goes, they're not being paid nothing. They're being paid a lot. I mean, when I first moved in, I've been in my neighborhood probably 20 years. There were all these guys, for whatever reason, kind of goes in spurts, Kevin. Everybody starts remodeling their house. Well, they had, tradesman's van in front of like six houses on the block maybe 15 years ago. And this is back when everybody's using all these laborers from other places, right? And what about these guys? And so I walk out, and there's this guy getting out of his truck in front of me, and I could tell he's from, where the hell is he from? He was from Russia, I think. Maybe Russia, or might have been Ireland. I think it was from Russia. They had all these Russian guys being all the carpentry work. And I said, hey, how are you doing? I said, what do you think of all the press about, they were bitching at the time about all these guys not being American. He goes, I understand what you're talking about. I don't see anybody here willing to do what I'm doing. He goes, I'm making union wage. He goes, I'm not in the union. He said, maybe you're not paying the benefits or something. I didn't want to go into that. But he goes, I don't see anybody here pushing me out of the job. It's not like, 15 white or black guys from Chicago are lining up in the morning saying, we're carpenters, we want that job. He goes, there's nobody here. The reason why I'm here, have this job, is they can't get anybody else. He said, oh, by the way, I'm so tired of people talking about I shouldn't be here. Next month I'm moving to London. They pay more and I got nothing but work. Okay, then. I mean, does any, other than lobbing the problem out at people saying, all these people shouldn't be here, they got all these jobs, does anybody really think, I mean, like Bill was saying 2 weeks ago, you get rid of some of these people, there's not anybody the next day willing to move and spend 3 years putting a water treatment plant in? I mean, we think there is, but it's always somebody else's kid. It's never ours. I mean, I think...
I hear what you're saying, Tom, but at the same time, I also think that if I can pay somebody a lot less money than what the market would bear without those interventions, I think once you start offering real money for people to work and to actually, you have to pay enough for it to be better to be working than it is to be sitting on the couch.
We got to go to Russell here, and I don't want to. How do you know other than Trump told you that all these people are working for these sub wages? I don't know that they are.
Because I know where I live, there's a lot of people working for substandard wages.
Well, here there isn't.
And they get arm-twisted into things like overtime off the books and anything else, because they always have the threat of being turned in.
Well, because here are the people who get...
A lot of very unscrupulous companies use that.
Even the restaurants here are above board. They didn't used to be. They're paying people at least minimum wages, and they're not hiring anybody that doesn't have a card. I mean, used to see that all over the place, Kevin. It's even ask these people that haven't been. I go to the bars downtown, and I say, is anybody doing that? Oh, no, we haven't done that for 20 years.
I talk to people all the time who have to deal with this shit.
Really? I'm not so sure that the people doing carpentry, I mean, the guys who put my roof on, they're mostly Mexican. I think they all made like $300-$400 a day. It wasn't like there was nothing.
It might not have been nothing, and they might have all been legal workers too.
Yeah, I mean, I'm saying, when what Bill was talking about is the guys working on these big huge projects, they're not paying nothing. And nobody, it's hard to get people to go because you actually have to move someplace for 2 years. You know, who the hell wants to do that?
Well, you know what? In 2008 and 2009, people were doing it like crazy.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're too old for that. We're not going to go 2 years and work on a oil well, are we? I don't think so.
I'm not going to, but I'm,
anyway, we'll talk at you Friday. Did you happen to watch, we'll do a sports for a second. Did you happen to watch a Cub game last night?
Yeah.
Two things. What has happened in Washington? When I went out there maybe 10, 12 years ago and watched the Cubs play, the place was packed. And, probably shouldn't say it, but the really good seats, I don't think I've ever seen a crop of better-looking women in my life. They're all the lobbyists giving their tickets to the... There was nobody there last night. It was the whole... The premier seats that are owned by every lobbyist... They couldn't have been a tenth full. You can't get people to go for free now, or maybe because you can't. You know, maybe I keep bragging about this and everybody thinks I'm nuts. Maybe the fact that you just can't give people a ticket to go, and everybody's got to give everybody their phone number and go through Major League Baseball. Maybe that is just a really bad idea, Kevin.
That might be an inhibitor towards for transferring tickets. That's entirely possible. I think people care a whole lot about whether the team's any good or not. You pay a lot of money to go to a baseball game. I'd really like to see good baseball.
Well, but you also, if it's a good game that night, you could go to the world's best team and see a clunker game, right? But also, I'm not encouraging anybody to be a fan of anybody because I'm not that much of a fan anymore, but if you've got any time, you can put some time in a game, it is worth watching one of these ball games to see this kid, Pete Crow Armstrong, play. Is he something like I've never seen or what?
Yeah, he really is. He's really outstanding, and he's only scratching the surface as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, he's starting to show a little more discipline at the plate, and I've been thinking, gosh, if that guy ever becomes a really disciplined with the strike zone, he's just gonna kill.
But how many stolen bases did he have last night? And he made a throw from deep center to second base on the fly. He's got a great arm. Nobody even talks about.
That all along, coming up through the minors, we knew that he had the highest possible grade as a defender, and he has absolutely lived up to that. But the team in general too. I didn't watch a lot of Cubs last year because they weren't any fun.
Yeah.
But they're almost like if I'm home, I'm putting them on and I'm paying attention because they're fun to watch. They play, I always. Russell will appreciate this as a teacher himself. When I'm teaching a management class, what I always tell my students is there are two things that offend me terribly. One of them is bad management, because that's just ruining people's lives who come to work for you 8 hours a day. And I just don't understand why anybody would be such a jerk like some managers are. But the other one is bad baseball.
Russell, did you guys hear about the... this dude who wants to spend $750 million of his own money to build a soccer stadium in the South Loop?
Yeah, I don't think it's quite that. And I thought we were going to talk about it today, but we didn't. So we'll get to
that. We'll talk Friday, because maybe with Russell, I'll give a little history of that area. But, they stiffed the hell out of is that Berwyn? Is it, what's the name of the place where the other one was?
Rodmore.
What?
Rodmore, I believe.
No.
No, the Broadview. Broadview.
No, it's not Broadview. It's I'll find it.
It's Broadview.
Alec Van Lines was in Broadview, and that was not in Broadview. It's a what's the name of the? It's a SeatGeek Stadium. They call it now.
Yeah,
SeatGeek Stadium, and it's in Broadview.
All right. Well, I'll look.
They paid $65 million to get out of their lease.
But they still the taxpayers have been hit with $11 million as of a few years ago.
Actually, lately, that stadium's actually been doing pretty well because they have a lower-level soccer team in there. They do get a few of the Chicago Fire games because, when they get conflicts in Soldier Field. And then they have Major League Lacrosse. They have professional rugby. They have a few of those. But what they've really
Bridgeview.
Yep,
Bridgeview. Close enough. Okay.
Yeah. Isn't that what I said originally?
I thought you said Broadway. Broadway. But they've had, they had to put extra soccer things in the parking lot because Salvador's kid plays there, and they charge everybody to go in. But for the first 5 years, they had to hit the taxpayers with $11 million just to make the payments. So they're not even on the deal. So. Anyway, but you're right, Kevin. They paid the $65 million.
They've been doing well in music festivals too. That's been the thing that's probably saving their butts more than anything.
Well, they have the flea markets 2 days a week too. Got to pay for that. When's the last time you guys went to a flea market?
I actually went to that flea market once. I found a really cool old Stocks and Jocks mug for 50 cents.
I'm surprised it was that expensive. Did you try and bargain them down to a quarter?
No. I assume it's going to go up in value at some point.
God. Kevin, I'll give Russell a little bit of the history of the South Loop here, and then we'll just talk about this. I want to get Russell's opinion on what we were talking about yesterday, these money supply numbers around the world and so forth. But if you want to hang on.
Real quickly before you do that, Russell, because I'm going to sign off. How are you guys coping with budget cuts?
We haven't had to deal with it too much. I'm picking up extra classes. That's the one thing that I've noticed.
Well, that'll do it.
Yeah,
I get it.
Which I'm fine with. I don't think we're intentionally doing this. I think it's just a circumstance, so we haven't had to deal with it. But within my small group, we're short a teacher going into next year, and instead of replacing them, everybody's picking up an extra class.
What about class size? Same, or is that increased a little bit too?
That won't change. And because honestly, the class sizes are based on the capacity of the rooms.
Okay.
And they're full.
Okay, so you guys are pretty full. So well, cool.
Yeah. Oh, we're full. I mean, we had almost a 50% increase in applicants for next year.
Nice. Why is?
Yeah, my daughter graduated Bennett over the weekend, and. You know, I knew this, but they started off the graduation by saying, you know, you guys are part of the largest graduating group in the history of the United States. And it's true. Right now, it's kind of funny. We have the most customers that we could ever have at higher ed right now.
Why are your places like? I think you guys are having record applications. I think the Irish probably are too. Why is Western Illinois damn near going under? Same way with Southern and Northern, and what's the problem there?
Well, I mean, it's just we've larger schools. I'm not going to say us, but because we pretty much I feel like handle what we can handle, but just a lot of larger schools. Are you know what? I'll tell you exactly what I was having this discussion. Yesterday with an Indiana professor, because 10 years ago you would never drive around the western suburbs and see a single SEC flag out front of a house.
Yeah, well.
And now you see there are more kids going to University of Tennessee than Purdue from my kids' high school. So the school and my comment was to the other professor, I was like, well, where are they coming from?
or who's getting hurt by that? And we really couldn't figure it out. You just answered it for me. It's because if you've got a 3.0 and a decent ACT, there are a handful of SEC schools that'll give you a full ride just because they're trying to expand their national footprint.
I know somebody who did that in Alabama. Vanderbilt's been a huge plucker of people, too, for a while.
Well, Vanderbilt's a little bit of an exception. I mean, they're a huge plucker of people, but they're a good school. You know, some of the SEC schools are not exactly the top of state institutions out there. But if your choice is Alabama or, you know, Western or Southern Illinois, I assume you would probably think about going to Alabama, especially if it's super cheap. So that's probably, yeah, they're not hurting the Big Ten. You know, it's not like somebody's not going to Indiana and choosing to go to Tennessee or Arkansas. But I'll bet it's the schools that you just mentioned.
Well, the
right there, I mean, it's kind of, isn't it great when you talk to more than one group of people?
Well, I mean, one of the
groupthink.
I was talking to my buddy Bill Murphy last night, and my attorney buddy, and I met one of his kids, one of the kid last year that he sort of an interview in the bar, but kid was sort of already hired. His dad and his grandfather both went to Notre Dame. The kid went to SMU, and now he's going to law school.
Now that's a good school.
Now he's going to law school in Texas. I'm going Texas
University of Texas. Yeah, University of Texas. And I don't include Texas when I'm talking. When I'm talking about these SEC schools that you never saw anybody go to, it's like, or you just didn't see the flags out in front of the houses.
Yeah.
It's like it's Kentucky and Tennessee and Arkansas, and you know it's and the SEC schools for some time now have been making a big effort to expand their alumni to other parts of the country outside of this, you know, the Southern Quadrant, and it's showing up. But that's what's hard. Yeah, I can't believe I didn't come up with that one yesterday. But it's the schools that you're talking about, the, you know, the directional type state schools that are you know one tier down. People are choosing to go to Auburn or Alabama or Tennessee or Kentucky instead of going to Western Illinois.
Well, somehow,
it's got to be, yeah.
You go to school locally.
Yeah.
Well, I think it used to be, the fallback position, if you didn't get into Illinois, you went to Western or Northern. Now it seems like if you don't get into Illinois, plus they don't want people from in the state because they don't pay as much.
You know what? If you want to go to, I don't know if it's still true, but a couple of weeks ago, I saw a list of universities that were still accepting people for the fall because they hadn't filled out their class yet, and Kentucky was on the list.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I know.
So
that
if you graduated and you didn't get in anywhere and you still want to go to a state school, you can probably get yourself into Kentucky right now.
Well, I know Maddie Weber's wife, the lovely Jill Weber. She, I don't, you know, I never asked her, but I don't know if she tried to get into Illinois and. Didn't she's in the Western Burbs, and she and a truckload of her friends all went to Iowa. There's if you go around Chicago and look at the different bars that are, you know, there's Wisconsin bars, Michigan. I think there's more Iowa bars than are in Illinois.
There's a lot of Iowa. Kid next door goes to Iowa. His older brother just graduated Kelly.
They love it. Mm. They love it.
Yeah.
I mean, and boy, they become friends and they meet up for stuff. I think there's more Iowa bars than are Illinois bars now.
There are a lot of Iowa graduates, Brandon. And, my kid got into Purdue, got into Indiana, did not get into Illinois.
Wow.
Illinois is fixated on out-of-state because they need the revenue.
Absolutely.
It just appears to be that just...
Well, yeah, they're not alone. Michigan, Ohio State.
And that's going to hurt them in the long run.
It's easier to get into Michigan now from Columbus than it is Ohio State. As my cousin who went there, my mother's cousin, said... If you could walk across campus and chew gum while you were doing it, you were in. Now it's a big deal to get into Ohio State. But if you're from Michigan, you get in. These kind of games we're playing on our population. And, you know, they're just games, Russell. I mean, so that's what we were talking about earlier in the show. We wonder why the difference between... I'm going to lob out there. You correct me because you know the answer. I'm going to say that tuition at Illinois now is... For an in-state person is 20. For out of state, it's 40. It's on that magnitude. It might be 18 versus 36 or something. And then, but now there's all kinds of people here that are not in here and are going to Iowa. Okay, that's you know, 20 times 4. It's 80 grand. Somebody is starting out in life, either the parents with less of it, or them with
no. That's 40. It's 40 times 4 because it's out of state.
No, I'm saying the difference.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. So yeah, an extra. Yeah.
I mean, and you know, and when I graduated school, I had no debt, none whatsoever. And I always had the freedom, whatever job I got. If ever I wanted to say take this job and shove it, I could have walked out. I didn't owe anybody anything. I don't see how somebody that age starts out in life now, especially with jobs, you know, being entrepreneurs harder and harder to get. I think how you have this huge weight on your ass when you start. I don't see how you even do that. I mean, the two guys that live upstairs in my building, they'll tell you I'm never going to own a new car. I'm never going to own a house. I owe you know, 200 grand in tuition or some shit. I mean, I can't imagine that. I mean, thinking like that when you're age 35. The world should be your oyster, and it's not.
No, it's definitely, it most definitely is not, and not just for the financial part as well. I met a handful of recent graduates, like, had been out in the real world for a year, and oh my God, you would have thought that it was us when we both had a really, really bad day having a discussion. Hate women, hate their jobs, no future. I mean, it was just just ridiculous. You know.
Well, you see,
I really would not. You know, everybody's like, if I could, you know, go back 40 years, blah, blah, you know, if I could be 40 years younger, man, I wouldn't want to be 40 years younger right now to save my life.
No, I
really wouldn't.
One of the guys who helps with the show once in a while, who shall go nameless, you know, he's in his 30s. And I said, you know, where's your babe? Basically, you know, where guys talk to each other. He goes, you have no idea. The last 5 or 6 girls that I talked to for a length, or maybe even had a date with, I find out one is on Ritalin, one's on something else. They've been taking drugs for like 12 years.
Yeah.
I mean, and the moods swing like there's no tomorrow if they take the drugs and don't. He goes, I said, what's wrong with them? He goes, there isn't anything wrong. They just somewhere along the line got on some of the stuff and they're taking stuff every day. And I'm going, this is before you have kids, before you have problems, you're already taking stuff. I mean, how do you start out with that? I'm not saying people shouldn't date somebody who's on, you know, any kind of drug, but boy, oh boy, it's like, it's kind of an odd world that we're sort of into. But hey, a question yesterday, we had the two other sort of professors. Well, Hal is a professor. I don't know if you, I mean, nobody watches this crap, I don't think, but I noticed our money supply starting to creep up, and all of a sudden last month took a big jump. When I say last month, again, it's April. We get a month behind because we're not trusted with the numbers. You can't handle the truth. But the last the last month was a 8.1% annual growth, and we've been nudging up to 5.1, 5.2, which is too high. But
yeah.
So then I went and looked at a whole bunch of other countries. Euro year over year is 3, February to April 3.8. So, you know, it doesn't sound like much, but it's quite the increase. This is UK, 2.6 year over year, last few months 3.9. India, year over year 9.4, last few months 28.8. Even Japan, year over year 0.08, because they don't ever do anything. Now, the last few months 2.4, which is what, 3 times their normal over the last
summer. That's ridiculous for them.
And my question to Hal and to Carl, we think Trump's in charge. He thinks he's in charge for sure. How does this seems a little coordinated to me, or am I just being a knucklehead here? I mean, somehow or another we're gonna solve the world's problems by putting more cash in again, and we're gonna inflate our way out of this mess, and yet, which we all know is going to really help some people and really screw other people. I mean, if you've got if you got your money in NVIDIA, you think it's the best thing that ever happened. Thing goes up, you know, 25 billion in market cap a day or more. You know, that's whether or not you like the company or not. That's sort of big numbers in a few days. It's kind of crazy. especially if you start looking at PE ratios and those kinds of things. But what's the bottom line here? Where does this all end? I mean, we're regular people. This inflation is, now they're going to lie about it. What's it going to be 6 months from now? 8 or 9%?
It quite possibly could be, and it probably you think maybe they'll blame the spike in inflation that we'll get, you know, from the additional money on tariffs.
Well, I mean, that's gonna,
is that a coordinated thing that, you know?
Well, here's what
we're gonna show Trump. We all want to keep we like the status quo. We're gonna show him. And,
well, but I mean, you're gonna.
But, and then the other side of it is it just a reaction to the tariffs to cushion the blow that some economies are feeling from it?
I think we're just pushing up asset prices because 1% of the people own 90% of the assets.
Okay.
I mean, you look at the combination of the tariff, which is an amazingly regressive tax, and this tax bill. And I sent out a memo yesterday. I'm not trying to be politically argumentative. Anybody who doesn't think that the combination of those two things really propels 1 or 2% of the population to the detriment of the other 98 is listening to the wrong guy or listening through, you know, filtered earplugs or something. I mean, the only thing that's kind of weird, Russell, is that I think we all sort of agree that the CPI is somewhat of a lie, right? Let's say it is, but now the tariffs, if we were to have a state's a federal sales tax, say, of 10%, everybody would be up in arms, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely up in arms. And, oh, by the way, CPI probably does not count that, right? Because the CPI counts what's on the shelf, doesn't count. You've never once read, when I say this, you know, listeners kind of listen to me a little bit more than normal. If you go buy a car, and if you go look at the CPI, and there's all kinds of detail about cars and stuff in there, they're going to look at the manufacturer's suggested retail price. Say it's 50 grand or 60 grand. Say 60. When you get that car, what's your sales tax? In Illinois, it's probably, I won't say it's 10, but say it's 9. It's another 5 grand. That's not on the price of the car, right? So one of the people who really love inflation is the government, because they make more dough. Also, that's not in the CPI. But now if you put a tariff on a car coming in and the car goes up from 60 to 65, that I think is going to be in the CPI. So even if it doesn't have the horrible effect that we think it does, I don't see how you hide that price increase, do you?
No, you can't.
Or they'll find a way.
I mean, it works its way through, and you know, you eventually you do see it. Because we talk about inflation a lot, I've just been, you know, deeply thinking about what's the motivation behind making life more difficult for average people to just, you know, is it a way of trying to control the population? Where you're so busy worried about, you know, paying all of your bills that you're not worried about what you know all of your leadership is truly up to. You know, that's what I'm trying to figure out. This,
you know,
is
what?
The thing is,
let me try.
I've been on here for. Oh, let me go.
All right.
I've been on here for you know some time, and we keep talking about how they're lying to us about inflation. Well, what? So, the why? Why would that's what I'm always trying to figure out is the why. And you know, it occurred to me that, you know, if you got statistics that say, you know, say that everything's somewhat fine, and they disconnect with the day to day, you know, you got Don Lemon out there on the street telling people that they're not right, your stuff doesn't cost more, the government figures say that's not right, you know, but you know, so what is that motivation? Why would you want to, you know, do that to your people? Because eventually they're gonna turn on you. If you've got enough people that are unhappy with their life, and this is starting to happen over in China, they're actually seeing some people that are pushing back with a little bit of protesting because they're not happy with their day-to-day life. But if you know, if you get enough people that are just frustrated as I'll be, and you know, barely getting by and not even saying, you know, like guys in their mid 20s that just don't even see a purpose, you know, why beyond, you know, working a job that allows me to sit around, play video games and get high and just kind of cruise through life, you know, what's the purpose behind trying to work harder and do better for yourself?
You have, yep. As usual, you've hit on mm-hmm. two or three questions that we've been stumbling through over the last couple of weeks, and I really want your opinion on what you just asked. I'll give you a quick one before break. I think the issue, I mean, I'm a little older than you. When I was growing up, just about everybody, you know, had a job. The guy, even if he was the manager at the Jewel, had a bungalow, had a car. I mean, it wasn't a Cadillac, and probably the wife didn't have to work, or, you know, in some cases the wife worked, but or did something on the side. And the economy was growing, I think, a real rate of 3 to 3.5%. So if somebody worked a little harder, or maybe he went to grad school and you didn't, and he did a little bit better than you, there wasn't all that much jealousy. Well, he works on Saturdays, I go play golf. Well, of course he made a little more than me last year. So there wasn't, when there's sustained growth for everybody, nobody really bitches about, I'm growing at 3, the other guy's growing at 4 or 2. You almost could make, it almost was justified, you know what I'm saying, for lack of a better term. One guy works overtime, I don't, that type of thing. Now, I think if you were to take, I honestly believe this, Russell, if you were to take the medical piece of the CPI and raise it from 6 to 20, which is really the percentage of the GDP that goes for it, and go back to the year 2000, you're going to find that there's zero growth,
mm-hmm.
or damn near zero growth. So now, if I, and you, and I think you see this attitude, I'm not leading a witness, for me to do really, really well, most people think it's because other people have to be negative, because the, in total, it's a flat line.
Mm-hmm.
And where people didn't used to think that. Everybody was growing, he's just growing a little faster, and maybe, you know, maybe he deserves it because he's working a little harder and went to school and I didn't, something along those lines. Now it's like every single time somebody seems to do better, it's at the expense of somebody else. I mean, you look at the people who, I don't know that much about it, what's the stupid coin that Trump's involved in, where you had the people for the big dinner? Somewhere on a CNBC article, there was something like, I don't know, Russell, was it 150, 200, 250 people that are up millions and millions of dollars on this coin, and they said 750,000 under other investors are down money. That's exactly kind of what I'm talking about. That somehow mm-hmm. or another, these 250 people, whether the thing's crooked or not, or anything about it, seem to have gotten a slice of 750,000 other people. It's not like 750,000 are up 5% and some people are up 15%. Everybody can roll mm-hmm. with that, I think. But wait a minute, these guys are way up and you're way down? You know, it's like, you know, it's like the one guy who wins the lottery, if it's straight, and everybody else loses. I mean, we're kind of in that, I don't know how to even describe it, but if all of a sudden somebody made a lot of dough, you almost sit there and go, okay, a guy made a lot of money in the stock market. Well, was that a trade? How many, we talk about it all the time. How many trades are being front run in the market? How many people mm-hmm. right now are making a bunch of dough and front running some announcement? Guess what? You made it because somebody else lost it. It's not a zero sum game, right? So I mean, I think people have this attitude.
It's not a zero sum game.
People have this attitude. No. The reason why I don't get a raise and don't get anything because the president of the damn place makes $50 million a year. I mean, I have a client. I don't know if you met him. I have a client whose wife's a real big shot at an advertising firm, and she's a terrific lady, and damn near brilliant when it comes to this stuff. And she's in a company. There's about 5 or 6 huge national advertising places. So the place A takes over place B. Number 2 in the list takes over number 4. Now, if we had any kind of an antitrust department, you'd sit there and go, we don't need that. So they're supposed to be valuing the stock of the second place at $35. Well, now it's 23. And guess what? The guy just laid off 7 to 10,000 people and is moving a lot of like his call centers or whatever over to India.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting there going, first of all, why did we allow this merger? Who is this guy? And now he's laying off 7,000 to 10,000 people. Well, they must do something all day. I mean, what? Why can he do it now? Because there's not enough competition that he can lower the value of the product and have somebody talking to somebody from India instead of somebody here because there's not as many firms. Now what? Do you have to let number one get together with number three because now it makes them more competitive? Now you only got two instead of four? I mean, what are we doing? Every place you and I look, we sit there and go, is anybody looking at this stuff? Is anybody putting two and two together? And I think the answer is no. And it doesn't matter who's president. To me, it seems there's a steering behind the curtain, whether it's big business, whether it's, you know, international conglomerates, whatever the hell it is. I don't think our people have a clue. I mean, I really don't. I mean, and my question to you is, who made the call 3 months ago for everybody in the world to start raising their money supply? Just like when the CPI you mentioned, which, by the way,
you think all the bankers got together and talked about that?
I don't know. I mean, you talk about the CPI.
You don't think that that a lot of economies saw some short-term slowing based on uncertainty around the tariffs, and they thought one of the ways to cushion that was to add some money?
Okay, wait a minute. You're the professor, and I asked the question. I have no idea. Did they get together at a pre-meeting for Jackson Hole?
It's one of two. Do you think they're all and you know, it's been a long, long, long time. I don't know. I don't even know if we coordinated in 2020.
I think we did.
You think we did? I know we did in 2008, but
everybody pumped 40% of money in the system. If you go to Euro, go to UK, go here, everybody did almost the same number, 35 to 40. Now whether they're just keeping pace or whether they're doing it with a meeting together in a bar or whether you see the other guy doing it and you do it. And the other question that you mentioned, the CPI, when I was a youth, and I said this yesterday, so I'm repeating a little bit, you know, I did the CPI stuff for Pullman. And, and you know, inflation was 10, 12%. It was huge. But you felt it 10 to 12% in the number. Yeah. The number said 10 to 12%. Now, I'm not saying that I was feeling 10 and the number really wasn't 9 or 11. I'm not that smart. But it wasn't like they're coming at me with, it's a 2. You're that kind of. So nobody ever, we never once questioned the number. I never, if it was 1% that month, I'd call the MBTA and say, by the way, the price of the contract just went up 1%. They'd say, okay, it couldn't have been a 15-second phone call. They never once said, what are you talking about? We think the number's wrong. It's only 0.5%. We're not giving you the whole one. Nobody ever said that. But somewhere between 1978 and now, nobody believes it. Now, where along the line did somebody have the balls to say, we're not giving them real numbers anymore? I mean, Mike Murphy, you probably listen to him on the show, his mom used to gather stuff for BLS in the Cleveland area. I think she was in pasta, rice, and all that kind of stuff on the shelves. There's no way on God's earth, because I knew Mike's mom pretty well, that she was sitting there, man, it looks like a box of rice is 79 cents. I better make it 69 to make it look good. I don't doubt there's no way on earth she would ever have done that. So my question is, working up the chain, who has the balls and the power to say, man, those aren't the numbers? I mean, somebody somewhere is still telling us that healthcare is 6% of your basket instead of 20. Who's the somebody? I mean, I'm just intrigued by this. You know, I'm absolutely intrigued by it. Who's the somebody? It doesn't seem like it's been progressive over 30-some years of 16 Republicans, 16 years of Democrats. It's not like anybody goes in and straightens this crap out.
No.
I mean, I don't think the number's coming to Trump. Man, it looks like the CPI is 3% this month. Oh, no, you better make it 2. I don't think that's happening. If it did, it wouldn't surprise me if he said made it 2, but that's another story. But, someplace, Remember the guys in Casablanca? Claude Rains said, I go with the wind, and right now the winds are blowing from Vichy.
I do not remember that one.
That's a good line, huh? Right now
lot of great lines in that movie. I don't remember that one.
Well, you know, when I was on the board of the SIBO, and you were tight with the SIBO for a long time, there was a lot of stuff that was unsaid But if you walked around and just, you could feel it in the air. It was never actually said that no matter how much a firm might cheat on an order, we're never going after him. But you just knew you didn't go after him. And it's amazing how people can communicate without saying a word, right?
You're going to have to let me take the fifth on that.
I know.
You were on the floor and on committees. I worked for them.
I'm saying, yeah. But it was a lot of the stuff was members' business. I mean, it was those kinds of things, and you could just tell, the people that they came after, and the people you really hoped they never were so egregious that you had to go after them. Because the SIBO, I think, was really good people and really tried
I feel like they did. I actually think, compliance-wise, you did not want to misbehave there. But also, our times didn't overlap. You were there years before I was.
Well, I remember when it first started.
I started in 2009, and you were long gone from the floor by then.
Yeah, well...
It may have been, what I'm saying is the culture may have been very, very different when I was there versus when you were there.
Well, I'll tell you what the difference was. We're kind of off topic, mm-hmm. but you're never off topic because you're always talking about people and people don't change, right? By the way, we should go to a break here at some point. But that's true. S&P futures down 2, Nasdaq down 12. If anything was going on crazy, we'd let you know. We can't get you away without talking about these interest rates creeping every day, but. Actually, they're down today, but when the difference was, Russell, was when every stock had to be every option on every stock only was traded in one crowd before there was dual listing. You could actually enforce the rules against anybody because it was your product, mm-hmm. and people were absolutely crazed that it was such a new industry that we had to be absolutely so straight. That we didn't want anybody cheating, even the big firms, who always thought the big firms always thought that the custom was theirs to do with as they felt like. So if they stole money from their own customer, that was their right. Mm-hmm. A whole different attitude than we did on the floor. We were like, no, that's our customer. We don't want anybody cheating, even you, that type of thing. Well, as soon as things became dual listed, and you started talking about orders where they came down and they wanted to take the other side of the order for solicitation or facilitation, those kinds of things. All of a sudden is, now if you don't let us do it, we'll just take all these spreads to the P-Coast. So your enforcement became part of the marketing of the exchange, which it never should, but it did. What I'm talking about is a simple order, simple example is, suppose somebody wants to come down and do a spread 1,000 times. And you go down to the crowd and you say, what's the market on the spread? I need 1,000 up market. Well, that's fine. That's liquid. It's a quarter 7/16, say, or a quarter 3/8, back before decimals. Mm-hmm. The firm guy's going to go, well, you know what? We're going to put this up at 1/2, and we'll let you guys participate in 1/2 of it. All right. Mm-hmm. So what's 1,000 times 1,250? 12,500.
Yeah,
you just stole from somebody because the firm wanted the other side of that order, and in order to get it done, they were able to make everybody else co-thieves.
Mm-hmm.
That never happened before there was a dual listing. Because now, if you don't let me do it, I'll take the order to P-Coast and I'll do it all out there. And all of a sudden, people's, we need the business here. We can't let them go on somewhere else. We have to start looking the other way.
You got to start being competitive. Yeah.
Meanwhile, somebody's out 12-5. And the last time I checked, it's a felony, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, we don't want to go too far down that road. One of the things that Kevin and I were talking about is, I think, Russell, the whole... I don't have any real problem. Matter of fact, I concur with Trump's idea of evening the playing field. I don't think you need to do it with broad-based tariffs everywhere. But I read you ever read anything from this Heritage Group?
Oh, yeah. The Heritage Foundation?
Yeah,
absolutely.
And I was reading,
and you know they're on the conservative side.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, they're pretty friggin' bright. The one guy did a summary of inflation inflation in this country, starting from the Civil War. It's the best article I've ever read on it, and that includes Milton Friedman and everybody. I mean, I quote the guy constantly. But there was one I read this weekend on tariffs. It was a whole kind of history of the tariff thing. Back when Jefferson had the original ones, and how we protected this industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize, I talked about it with Jan Flanagan on Monday. The Civil War almost started 20 years earlier over tariffs. I
had not heard that before.
Carolina actually, was it North Carolina, put a law and said they were not going to collect tariffs. Because the North wanted tariffs to protect the garment industry, and the South didn't because they were exporting stuff.
Yeah.
So it was almost as big a fight over that than there was on slavery. It might have been bigger, actually.
You can just basically get your whole life canceled by saying what I'm gonna say, but that war had a lot more to do with a lot of issues between the North and the South, other than just the one primary issue that people cite.
Well, it had to do with
there was a lot of North South conflict, and I mean I think the main issue was slavery, but there were a lot of other issues as well.
Well, the
there really were, and it's because there were two extremely different economic models.
Yes.
One was very agrarian, and one was very manufacturing. And what's good for a manufacturing economy is not necessarily good for an agrarian one.
I didn't realize that
and
the
vice
union,
versa.
Well, the union actually threatened North Carolina to invade if they didn't collect the tariffs. That they were going to invade and take over the ports. I had no idea of that. Well, I mean, I should know this stuff. But I'm saying it's been a super controversial kind of thing. But what we were talking about is, if you do this, you would like the idea. They're almost the same people, Biden and Trump, talking about the middle class, Obama, the middle class, you name it. And yet, I think the ability of you and me to see an opportunity here coming back to find a place, get the financing, market the stuff, I think our ability is less than I've ever seen in my lifetime for entrepreneurs to actually go get marketing, go get, I mean, if it's a good idea, somebody's going to want to buy it from you. The people that can get financing for way less than inflation, make sure you don't get it. Well, you and I are going to what? We're going to have to go do it on our credit cards and pay 25%. How the hell are we going to make money at it when we're paying 25% when everybody else is paying 4%? I mean, I think the whole system, maybe it's because this stuff went overseas in the first place. I don't think banks want to talk to us, do they? Big banks?
No.
I mean, the whole system, I think, the idea that we're going to throw this big tax on people, and don't worry, in 6 months it's going to come back to you in spades because you're going to get this job for $50 an hour, and now you're flipping burgers at McDonald's. I don't see that happening. I think an awful lot of stuff has to get in place first for that even to begin to happen, don't you?
Yeah. There's an awful lot that needs to be likely flipped around, what's the first move?
Well, I mean, the administration, Trump and Pritzker, Pritzker, same way. They both want to stride through Saudi investment someplace, go pitch out the first shovel, just like, you know, Pritzker wants his place down where his self works. You don't know if he can pull it off. My hat's off to the guy. But that's not the same as 50 people in Chicago going to their bank this week and saying, I got an idea. Here's the idea. I'm putting up some amount of capital. I'd like a loan for the rest, and having the thing start 3 weeks from now, shovel in the ground, or start remodeling an old place. That's what has to happen, and I don't see that happening at all. Do you?
No, and nobody wants to loan. You just can't get the money to do things like you're talking about. Do you know verbatim what you just said? You know who Jack Ma is?
Not the guy from China.
Yep.
Okay.
That is basically what he said that got him canceled over there.
Really?
He said that the banks need to start being, not loan based on assets, but loan based on ideas, and it's what we need to do to get this economy going. And by saying, I was watching a video about that last night. And what you just said is almost verbatim what he said about the Chinese banking system that got him in so much trouble.
Well, I mentioned earlier, there's a couple of guys...
Which is kind of funny, because aren't they supposed to be this, you know, great entrepreneurial society that's going to put the rest of us to shame?
As long as the right guys are in charge. I mean, you and I could get the money if we went to one of the angel investors where we're going to pay 9%, and oh, by the way, they want 51% of our firm. Why would we do that?
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to find that kind of money, but who the hell... I mean... You know, what is anyway? Go back to this tariff argument. I'll see if you agree. The guy was saying that nothing has been a bigger boon for business in the world than the original General Agreement of Tariff on Trade, which followed up with the World Trade Organization to minimize barriers to trade. He goes, every country in the world has benefited by that, including the U.S. So a couple countries have been a little slow, you know, with the wages going up and everything, like Mexico, but there's essentially, there's still hope for them. But he says the big fly in the ointment is China, because we somehow let them in, and they've never paid by any of the rules since day one.
No, they haven't.
Yeah, and he goes, and that's a problem. And now companies got so happy going over there, essentially getting slave and coolie labor, and cutting stuff down. And plus, you have to blame the economy here. I mean, if you see some family, 3-4 kids that aren't making a whole bunch of scratch, and they're running into the old Navy and buying everything from China, do you blame them?
No, not at all. Not in the least.
I mean, I've said this 100 times.
No, you know what? I can't blame an do away with oil activist that benefits from all of the things that you get from oil, you know, which is basically everything.
Yeah.
I think just about everything I'm looking at in my den right now has some sort of, you know, I understand they want to do that. But I hate when, you know, an activist is like, we've got to ban oil and, you know, got some conservative guy that looks like me that says, yeah, but you know, if you do that, you know, the shoes you wear go away, the, you know, the phone case, blah blah blah, you know, you've got to live in the society that you got.
I hope you're not in a I hope you're not in a polyester sweater.
Yeah, I don't know if I would have to give up the sweater best. The buttons. That would be a problem.
I mean, if you're wearing all polys, you don't want to go near a flame. Your level will go up.
No, you do not.
That was one of the things on the trading floor. Somebody wore something bizarre. Somebody would go, how many polys died for those pants?
Love it.
There weren't a whole lot of secrets on the trading floor. Especially like the one that did those shoes come with a prescription.
I was given a talk to a pit once about a new product. And I was wearing kind of it was springtime, and I was wearing a brightly colored cardigan. And I don't know who said it, but somebody said, how are we supposed to take you seriously with you wearing that shit, man? Stuff, man.
I mean, there was no... but you know,
I go, no argument for me. Trust me, if I'd known they were going to send me down here, I would have dressed differently today.
Remember,
just took it and went with it.
Remember,
I knew when they sent me down there that when they said, "Could you go down there and talk to these guys just for a few minutes?" They got some follow up questions on I don't even remember what the product was. I said, "Yeah, absolutely, sure," but I was like, "Oh my god, I just know I'm going to get hazed while I'm down there a little bit."
Remember,
which is totally fine. It's part of life.
Remember Phil Graham, Wendy Graham's husband, and then we talk about. Mm-hmm. There's somebody, I don't know how she avoided the jail cell. She was on the Enron board, and she was in charge of governance.
Yeah.
What the hell?
Sorry. I didn't know that.
Yeah, she was in charge of governance, the governance committee.
Oh, my.
Well, so Phil Graham, gosh. We went out to one of those shindigs in Washington, and Dr. J had just become a first-year board member, right? So Jan always liked to go, whenever we're in New York, we'd always go over to Canal Street. Have you ever done that? Canal Street, everything is available out on tables in the street, Canal Street.
Oh, yeah, where you can...
You know, if you want a Chanel this or...
My wallet came from there.
Remember,
yes.
Well, my buddy Mark Duffy, he always did well. He always liked the, Mont Blanc pens, right?
Yeah.
So he always had the, he has got a collection of Mont Blanc pens. And we go to the board meeting, and he'd sit down. And well, you could buy fake Mont Blanc pens at Canal Street for like $5.
Yeah.
So the next board meeting, Jan and I sit on either side of Duffy, and we'd plunk our Mont Blanc pen right next to his. But they
did he automatically go, I know that's fake?
No, he just said, hey, where'd you guys get those?
But, and hey, I just want to tell you, I was in New York about a week. Actually, last week I was in New York, and I went to where I bought my wallet, you know, where the guy usually is selling some of the knockoff crap. I couldn't find any of those knockoff guys on the street, and I think that's part of the ice stuff.
Really? It was all on Canal Street back then.
Well, and I mean, there are certain spots around Times Square that you can also, it's the same thing. And I was like, I need a new wallet. I'm going to walk over here. And I couldn't find those guys.
Well, they used to have the fake Rolex watches, right? So I look at one, and I said, this thing looks pretty cheesy. It was like 20 mm-hmm. bucks. He goes, oh, you want a good one? He pulls one out from underneath the thing. Looked just like a Rolex. He goes, that's 50 bucks. I didn't buy it. But Jan used to buy the wildest color ties, which is kind of weird because Jan's colorblind, right? So he has this incredibly bright yellow tie that he buys from there, and he wears it to the meeting the next morning. And Phil Graham walks in, he's drinking his coffee, he looks at Johnny, goes, son, where'd you get that tie? That thing's pretty bright. You don't need any coffee in the morning.
It's going to wake up the room.
He's like, it'll wake me up. Here's Senator Graham giving John crap about his tie, right? But anyway, of course he deserved it, but still. But yeah, I just wonder, a lot of stuff, it's almost, I use the analogy of Russell, and it's such a dumb one. If somebody's laying there dead, you can't say, well, if we just get the heart going, all of a sudden he's back alive. Oh, because wait a minute, the brain didn't tell the heart to start. Okay, yeah. Well, let's get the brain going. The human body, either sort of everything's working or nothing's working. I mean, same way as an economy. You and I have studied this our whole life. We have a more of an appreciation about how it all, and we not to say we understand it all, because we don't, because it's too big to understand. We have an appreciation for how, if one part isn't working, if your butthole's not working, the rest of you is not feeling too good, right? I mean, no matter what it is, everything's got to be working together.
In sync.
And if it isn't, it's really hard to get stuff going. I mean, you did it. Actually, everybody thinks it happened in after December 7th. All of a sudden, within 2 weeks, had all these factories going. That's the biggest load of crap.
Imagine,
but that all started in 1939 when we were making stuff for the people in Europe. We were already well down the way in munitions.
We were prepping.
Yeah,
we were getting ready.
And you know, the idea that, well, you need this part, you need these people, you need these tools, you need this factory. I mean, everything. We need the ships to move the stuff there. It takes a while, and you can't leave one piece out.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say, oh, by the way, everybody has to go out and start factories now. Look what I just did for you. Oh, by the way, this Dodd-Frank thing is in the way. In order for you to borrow $50, you got to sign your house away. Nobody's going to do that. Or you got to go use a credit card at 25%. No, you can't do that. Nobody's going to make that kind of money. I mean, it is all.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys, when you see the students coming and going, do they get a sense of this? I mean, how many people, pile out of there with some huge debt? Does anybody come out of there with no debt?
Oh, I think some people come out of it with no debt. Indiana is not an expensive school.
Well, you're from Indiana.
In state, for IU is like 14, 15 grand.
Really? How, what's the...
The state, you know, and I don't know how the budgets work for other schools, but the state controls a lot of what we do. Like, believe it, I guess I did get a raise. I'll find out in a couple of weeks. But my raise actually is not official until it's approved by the state legislature.
Okay.
There's a huge bill about everything that we want to do, and that thing is negotiated out in a committee. And we receive a lot of money from the state of Indiana, and which makes us one of the less expensive Big Ten schools, especially for in-state kids. One of our big goals is to educate people within the state of Indiana and keep them there. That's what we want to do. The goal, you know, there are other schools that, you know, to get by, that can't be their goal.
Because
out of state students are more valuable. You get to put them in a dorm. You get to, you know, they're not getting to go home for dinner. You know, you get to charge them for the meal plan, et cetera. So I, you know, and I understand that, but when I went to Memphis State, I went there undergrad, and you know, my dad, my uncle, my mom, and my dad met in the cafeteria where I used to go to breakfast. I was like the 12th or 13th person in a row to go to Memphis or Memphis State. And when I went back to go to graduate school there, I talked to them about having a graduate assistantship, and they only gave them to students that came from outside of the United States. And I was kind of close to a professor, and he said, look, you know, you're going to want to go away for the week of spring break. These kids are going to sit around and grade papers for me. You know, they had a very logical argument as to why, you know, they would rather have, you know, somebody from that can't work a job in the U.S. Kind of beholden to them. So when you got your master's degree at Memphis, you didn't do a dissertation. You had an oral exam where you had three professors that you had taken that really kind of grill you on anything you should have learned in graduate school. And then after they tell you you passed, they said, do you have any feedback for us? And I said, yeah, I'm never going to give you guys a dime. And I haven't. I said, I'm not going to give you a dime because in order to pay for school, I had to deliver pizza a couple of nights a week, and you guys wouldn't give me a graduate assistantship. I'm never going to give you a dime. And they've called and asked for money a couple of times, and I've repeated that to them. I haven't been a jerk about it, but I've repeated it to them. I've said, look, if you let me work for 10 hours a week under a professor, I wouldn't have had to do this other crappy job, and I would be forever indebted to you guys. And now that I've done well, I would, you know, be happy to send you a check every year. But I have stuck to that the 30 plus years since I've left there.
Yeah, but look at all the tips.
And that kind of short-sightedness shows up in a lot of places.
Well, what do you think? Last question, because we got a dash
and,
here.
And I think the short-sightedness of trying to get somebody from another country to come to your university as opposed to giving it to somebody that's local that might come back and be a guest speaker, that will donate, might send their kids there as well. You're going to hurt yourself long term if you're not focusing in on having a long term plan and realizing the repercussions of short term decisions.
Same question as on two different subjects earlier in the program, and we got a dash. You're there, and I don't want you talking about it for different schools, but I'm free to say I know people that have been in the admissions offices. And mm-hmm. I know people in Columbus that are real tight with Ohio State. Absolutely, Ohio State will favor somebody from Michigan versus Ohio now because they pay more. Michigan will mm-hmm. absolutely favor somebody from Illinois or Ohio because they pay more. Now, your legislators, your governors, your judges, whatever it is, do they just not know that? Do they all agree with it? Do they just never bring it up? I'm getting more and more as they age.
I don't think it's a topic that's on their radar.
But how do they not know if I know?
Because you interact with some people that are involved in higher ed on a pretty regular basis. That's one reason that you know. Because I have these discussions with people who are getting ready to send their kids to college, and there are a lot of things that they just aren't aware of.
Well, my cousin's from Columbus, and he tells me how hard it is for people in Columbus to get Ohio State now. How does the representative or senator from his district not know that? What, are they a moron?
I don't think it's a topic they care enough about because it's you know, it's not a 2-year topic.
But
and
I mean,
the representatives are 2-year people.
I think, though, Russell, you correct me here, but I think that people like that, representatives, I mean, I won't say I know her pretty well, but I know one of the ladies was a representative or a senator for Indiana out of the Portage area. She's at every barbecue. I mean, it's not like she doesn't have security. there's no way that they do not get that kind of feedback from people. They have to get it. They just ignore it or what?
Well, they, I'm sure they hear about those types of things, but if it's something that only a half a percent of their constituency cares about, you know, they got to make a judgment call on that one. And how much effort are you going to put into that?
I think they actually do pick up the phone and say, what are we doing? And somebody from the university saying, oh, by the way, if we don't do this, you idiots got to come up with $10 million more dollars a year. And they don't, and they actually approve it on some level.
This is not an issue in Indiana. This is more of an Illinois issue.
You know, I
Illinois has a money problem, and when you have a money problem, you know, whenever you have a money problem, there are things in life that are nice to haves and things that you have to have. And if they need a certain, you know, if a university needs a certain amount of money to keep the lights on, they're going to make judgment calls based on that, because that's the primary thing. If you can't keep the lights on, you can't do anything for anybody.
Well, there used to be reciprocal tuition rates between Illinois and Indiana, and somehow that stopped, I'm going to say, 15 years ago.
I think there's still some of that, but not to the extent that they used to have.
All right. I think
there's some border counties that work that. Like, Memphis State, University of Memphis, if you're, like, in northern Mississippi or western Arkansas or even a southern part of Missouri, you actually can get in state.
Okay, because you're close enough. All right, fair enough.
Yeah, because you're within 120 miles.
Are you here or are you Indy? Where are you?
I am here. I've got a dog sitting on me. I'm getting ready to send you a picture of a very happy person in her first day interning at NBC.
Oh, good for you. Know what? That was great last week having you guys
in
here.
Yeah, she enjoyed being here. It was like a primary thing that she needed to do while she was in Chicago.
Well, good for her, good for you. We will talk next week. Maybe next time I'll see you. We can have a cup of coffee or something before you have to dash. By the way,
yeah, sorry about that. I had I was a little bit late too. But
I didn't think you were going to make it. But all right, take care of yourself. SP futures up 75 cents. NASDAQ futures up 50 cents. That's why we didn't talk so much market. Nothing's happening. I'll be back tomorrow. Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.